Good evening. In the news tonight, much of Pennsylvania's controversial voter ID law has been put on hold until after the election. A new report examines the impact of solitary confinement on inmates in New York State prisons, and a government request to get cell phone location data without a search warrant gets a hearing in a federal appeals court. With these and other stories, I'm Andrea Sears in New York, and this is the news for Tuesday, October 2nd, 2012. There was a victory today for Pennsylvania voters who are not going to be allowed to vote in the upcoming election. A Pennsylvania judge today delayed full implementation of a controversial law that requires a photo ID to vote in the November election. The judge, who last month upheld the law, had been ordered by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court to hold further hearings and was told the law needed to be stopped if he found that voters had not been given enough time to secure the photo ID the law required. After rehearing arguments, the judge ruled the law would not be in place for the November election, but that it would be implemented immediately afterward. The ruling was music to the ears of civil rights advocates who've waged a battle against Republican-sponsored laws they say were enacted to disenfranchise voters more likely to vote Democratic, such as blacks, senior citizens, and students. WBAI's Jose Santiago discussed today's ruling with Keisha Gaskins, senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice of the NYU School of Law.
The court came back and said it would, in fact, issue a preliminary injunction on the basis that it found that there would be voters that would likely be disenfranchised by Pennsylvania's law. So what it did was to impose the pre-implementation requirements of the law, which is that voters can be asked for an ID, but if they do not have one, they simply need to be notified that they would need one in the future and be able to cast a regular ballot.
So right now, this voter ID law essentially won't be in effect for the November election?
It will not.
I see. But does this end it? Will it still be there after this election and future elections?
Right now, it only enjoins for purposes of this election, and then we're waiting, of course, because the judge in that case will set the issue of its constitutionality and the question of a permanent injunction on for trial.
On the ground, in terms of people who were planning to vote and were scrambling all over the state to try to get ID, what does this mean for the average voter?
What this means is that for people who were unable to obtain an ID or who were concerned that they may not be able to get an ID in time, that they will not be required to produce a photo ID to vote. So it returns Pennsylvania to its previous position.
And can you give us an idea of what the arguments have been, what the issues were that people were saying that it was making it very difficult for them to vote?
You had a range of individuals. You had some who simply said, look, I simply don't drive anymore. I don't have an ID. To, I lost my ID. I don't have a birth certificate. I was never issued a birth certificate. One of the plaintiffs could not get an ID because her birth certificate was in English. Her marriage license was in Hebrew, and nobody could read it to affirm her identity, to change, to give her a photo ID that matched her legal name.
When this issue was debated in the various courts, what was the sense of what kind of impact these laws would have had if it had remained in place for the November 7th election?
Certainly the different sides had different thoughts as to the breadth of the impact. But not even considering Pennsylvania citizens who are eligible to vote but not registered, the state of Pennsylvania testified to a number that was as low as 100,000 people. And there was evidence that the state put out that there was as many as 750,000 people that were registered but lacked ID. So there was an enormous range in terms of who said what and how many people were missing. But there was absolutely no dispute that tens to hundreds of thousands of Pennsylvania citizens were registered voters and lacked a state-issue ID that complied with the law.
I see. And what can you tell us about the national picture? How does this fit into the larger national picture of so many other states that have similar laws in place?
How it fits into the national picture, of course, is that what we're seeing is a serious pushback in some of these laws. It's consistent with many of the decisions that courts have considered. Where courts have considered these laws, they've been blocked or stayed because the operation of the law was making it so difficult for people to vote. It was either, as in Pennsylvania, unfairly disenfranchising voters across the board, or, as in Texas, there were findings of discrimination in passing these laws.
Mm-hmm. People feeling a sense of relief that you were able to have some success in the challenge?
Certainly in Pennsylvania, right? I can guarantee that citizens in Tennessee and Kansas who have newly passed laws that will be in place for the election still find themselves having to organize and make sure that individuals who want to vote are able to do so. You know, whereas we've seen some really clear electoral victories in courts in Florida, Ohio, Missouri, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Texas, and we're waiting on South Carolina, we remain hopeful. On the flip side, we did see preclearance in Virginia, we know that, and New Hampshire, we know that Rhode Island, all of those three states, while not implementing a strict voter ID law, have changed the voting requirements very, very close to the election. And these are all states where we want to make sure that people understand what the law is and are still able to access the polls. You know, we're heartened by the Pennsylvania decision. It really reflects what, you know, what we already knew, which was this law was going to block people from voting. Certainly the fight isn't over, and that litigation will continue. And we expect to see more of this in the next legislative session. And we'll continue to push back against these laws. But it is reassuring to see that when the courts have considered these laws, that there has been a fair amount of pushback that is allowing more Americans free and fair access to the ballot.
Keisha Gaskins is senior counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice of the NYU School of Law. She spoke with WBAI's Jose Santiago. The New York Civil Liberties Union released a report today called Boxed In, which addresses the use and effects of solitary confinement and severe isolation in New York State prisons. WBAI's Phil Bader has more.
1 year in the making, Boxed In compiles the interviews of prisoners, their families, and prison officials, along with extensive Corrections Department documents. Donna Lieberman is the executive director of the NYCLU, and she says the use of extreme isolation as a punishment has been going on for decades, has horrifying effects on inmates, and probably violates international law.
Extreme isolation is excruciating. It's debilitating, disorienting, desensitizing, dehumanizing. And in New York State, it's doled out far too often, for far too long, and with far too little process or safeguards against abuse. Instead of serving as the punishment of last resort, extreme isolation appears to have become the remedy of choice for the New York State Department of Corrections. It is almost cavalierly doled out to people for the most minor of offenses, substance abuse, talking back, and I'm not making this up, having too many postage stamps in your cell.
Last year, 13,500 sentences to solitary confinement or extreme isolation were doled out. 8% of the state prison system's entire population, or approximately 4,500 prisoners, were held in the box at any one time. But New York State employs an unusual brand of solitary confinement, according to Donna Lieberman.
The other half of the 4,500 prisoners in extreme isolation are subjected to a variation on solitary confinement, the peculiar hell of being stuffed two in a cell with a stranger in an area the size of a parking spot. That's why we use the term extreme isolation instead of solitary confinement.
The psychological effects of extreme isolation are not limited to people housed in single cells. Inmates housed for extended periods of time in pairs can have the same or even worse consequences, according to Taylor Pendergrass, senior attorney and co-author of the report.
It is certainly the case that we uncovered as a result of our investigation the kind of special and unique, horrifying consequences of having to be placed under those conditions with a complete and total stranger in a very cramped and tiny cell where every single private act that you take is done within the presence of another human being. As you all might expect, we found as a result of our investigation that violence, or the constant threat of violence between bunkmates, was rampant, even amongst bunkmates that professed liking one another.
The average sentence to extreme isolation is 5 months. But in one case, a prisoner languished in solitary for over 20 years. The report says that these practices cause a public safety hazard because 10% of the 20,000 prisoners released every year go directly from isolation to the streets without any counseling, reintegration, or remedial intervention. But according to Taylor Pendergrass, there is good news.
New York's regime of extreme isolation is a human rights crisis. But the good news is that this crisis represents a tremendous opportunity for our state to turn the corner on ineffective and inhumane criminal justice practices that have been sustained for far too long only on rhetoric and assumption. First, let's be clear. Prisoner separation is a sometimes necessary tool for corrections officials. But New York's regime of extreme isolation has warped that legitimate use beyond any recognition. We can get back to a rational, humane, and limited use of prisoner separation. Other states have already shown the way. In Colorado, for example, the legislature recently ordered an independent review of the state's use of prisoner separation. As a result of that review, 30% of prisoners have already been sent back to the general population, and the review is still underway. In Maine, the legislature commissioned a similar independent study, and 70% of prisoners were transferred back to the general prison population. And in Mississippi, thanks to an ACLU lawsuit, the state examined the entire population that was held in separation and the rationale for their placement in separation. 85% of prisoners were transferred back to the general prison population as a result of that review.
The entire report, released today, can be found on the New York Civil Liberties website at www.nyclu.org/boxedin. For WBAI News, I'm Phil Bader.
The U.S. Court of Appeals in New Orleans heard arguments this morning in a case challenging the government's authority to obtain cell phone location data from service providers without a warrant. The government had sought judicial orders authorizing the disclosure of 60 days of location data from two cell phone companies as part of a routine law enforcement investigation, but a magistrate judge denied that request, saying the government would have to apply for a search warrant supported by probable cause. The federal district court agreed that the magistrate judge could require a search warrant, so the government has now taken the case to the Court of Appeals. Rebecca Jeske is a digital rights analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which argued the case in court against the government today. She says the government is trying to exploit the differences between landlines and cell phones to claim that cell phone users have surrendered their privacy rights.
In the past, there's been discussion of a third-party doctrine, meaning if you voluntarily give up some information to a third party, then you've given up your right of privacy. And in the digital age, every time we make a phone call, send an email, third parties are involved in these transactions and these exchanges of information. If any time a third party helped you make a communication, you've lost your privacy rights in that communication, then we've lost our privacy rights in the 21st century. And that's one of the things that we're trying to stop here. Technology used to work differently, and the parallels aren't the same. It's time to update the laws.
Especially since 2001, the government has taken it for granted that it can ask for just about anything from any communications service provider. And in many cases, those requests have been granted without court review. So how do we know how often the government is seeking this kind of information?
We don't, actually. You've raised a really good point here, that what the government is asking for, they actually did go to a court to try to get this information, and it's a D order. It's somewhere between a subpoena and a warrant, where they don't have to reach a warrant standard, probable cause standard, but they're still asking for review by a judge. We don't know how many magistrate judges just approved these orders. Quite a few of them, probably. We spotted them when some of the magistrate judges across the country have started asking for argument on the issues, that they didn't want to just rubber stamp these requests from law enforcement. We began hearing about them in 2005. And right now, three different circuit courts have differing opinions on whether this is an okay use of authority by law enforcement. It's becoming a bigger and bigger issue, and it may well end up in front of the Supreme Court.
Now, there was a Supreme Court case in which the Supreme Court said that a search warrant was required to attach a GPS tracking device to a suspect's car. Is this in any way the same type of situation, or is the fact that someone subscribes to a cell phone service make it that much different?
The Jones case was when law enforcement went onto someone's property and put a GPS device onto the vehicle and tracked it nonstop, and the Supreme Court had a couple of different questions about how the device was attached, in addition to other privacy questions. One of the interesting things is that Justice Sotomayor had some questions specifically about the third-party doctrine and how, if you share information with a third party, you might lose your privacy rights, and how she felt like that needed to be re-examined in the 21st century. And we think she's spot on for that.
How is the Electronic Frontier Foundation approaching this? What are the arguments that your lawyers will be making in court in favor of a search warrant for this kind of information?
Well, we're going at it from a constitutional point of view. We have a Fourth Amendment right for privacy and against unwarranted search and seizure. What this is it's unwarranted search and seizure of your location data, where you are physically throughout your day. It's extraordinarily private information. And in some cases, law enforcement may need that data for investigating a crime. All we're saying is that you need to reach a probable cause standard before you can get this incredibly intimate information about someone's life.
And if you are unsuccessful, if law enforcement is in fact able to obtain this with something less than a probable cause finding by a judge, what is the threat to people's privacy, or what will be the impact on the average person?
Right now there's a circuit split, with some of the different circuit courts reaching different opinions about whether this is appropriate law enforcement procedure. But if we get to a Supreme Court ruling where law enforcement can get access to your location data basically whenever it decides it needs it, we've got a pretty serious privacy problem. When you go about your day, your physical location and your routines tell a lot about your place of worship, what your hobbies are, where your family is, where your friends are, your medical appointments. This is pretty sensitive stuff, and it's extraordinarily important for our privacy to be able to keep that private unless law enforcement has a warrant.
It would also give a pretty good idea of your politics.
Absolutely. What kind of meetings you go to? One of the interesting things, it doesn't just show your routine, it shows when you break your routine. So you go from point A to point B every Friday at 11 may show that you have a medical appointment, you know, or a political meeting or something. Well, what happens when you don't do that on that day? Is that the kind of thing that would attract law enforcement attention if you broke out of your routine? You can learn so much about what people do every day. Their activities say so much about their true private lives that it's really important to ask law enforcement to get a warrant.
So cell phones should not become the next best thing to have an RFID chip implant.
And sadly, we're pretty close to that. I mean, we have these with us all the time, this hearings about location data. But think about all the data that comes in and out of your phone. It's not just where you are. It's what you're thinking about when you're there. If you're searching for something, if you're using a particular application, I have a smartphone. I use it all the time. But it's terrifying to think about if someone had the records of what I do all day, every day with this phone, how much they know about me. For me, it's a big frustration. You have these great technological devices that really help and enhance your life, whether it's a toll transponder or a smart transit card that lets you use a bunch of different transit agencies with just a tap of the card, your smartphone. We shouldn't have to give up these extraordinarily convenient developments in order to keep our privacy.
Rebecca Jeske is a digital rights analyst with the Electronic Frontier Foundation based in San Francisco, California. A conference in New York today looked at the human face of big data. Participants looked at the ability to collect, analyze, and visualize vast amounts of data in real time. WBAI's Linda Perry was there and files this report.
When some people look at data, they see numbers and then their attention fades. Others look into how data breaks down, at filters which expand and refine information to give a fuller picture of the information gathered. That's the approach scientists, data entrepreneurs, and innovators shared at the Face of Big Data conference in Manhattan today. The impetus for the gathering is Rick Smolin's latest media project called The Human Face of Big Data. It includes a smartphone app and a book of photography and infographics. Infographics are visual displays from data collected. Smolin says, now the human race has suddenly developed the ability to collect information, analyze it, visualize it, and respond to the information while it is still being gathered, an ability we've never had before. He says it sounds very nerdy and technical and geeky.
I thought it'd be really interesting to try to put a human face on this and explain how it's affecting our children's lives and our parents' lives and how it's going to sort of transform our lives going forward. This is like what the internet was in 1993, just the first year it was entering people's lives. And the book is full of very, if you picture National Geographic kind of pictures, it's like, well, how could you photograph data? I mean, what kind of picture could you possibly take? So we're talking about, there's a wonderful picture in the book of aging in place in America, how technology is enabling older people to live safely in their homes. We're almost got to the point where we can actually choose to actually enhance our children's longevity or intelligence or immunity to disease. There's so many stories in the book that sort of give you goosebumps. And either, I mean, the whole book is not just yay big data. We talk about the dark side of it, about the invasion of privacy. But overall, I think that it's like watching the planet suddenly develop a nervous system.
And if you look at infographics of approximately 50,000 airplanes in the air at a given time, their trajectories look like veins spreading across the planet. Looking at Facebook users throughout the world on a NASA site called iGlobe shows a map composed of only those countries which are on Facebook. As data gets bigger, the planet seems to get smaller. Smolin sees the use of data changing and being used for social good.
Until recently, data was in the hands of the government or governments and corporations. And I think what's happening now for the first time in human history, mere mortals, ordinary people, suddenly have access to a lot of information that they can use to understand what's going on. You see it changing politics in the Middle East. You see it's changing politics here. And the fact that when a politician says something, you can actually immediately go see, is that true? Did they change their mind because they were in my city today?
Smolin says it's the media which always filtered how the public views politicians and politics, but now people have a direct way of accessing information.
If you go to Twitter right now or Facebook, there's sites dedicated to every speech that every politician gives right now. You've got a million people fact-checking for you. And what we saw today with Scott Harrison, a charity award, was so inspiring. Here's a guy all by himself who's literally sitting on his couch said, I want to do something about people in the world that don't have access to clean drinking water. And using the internet and information, it's totally changed the relationship people have with this idea of donations.
Scott Harrison is the founder and CEO of Charity Water. It's working to bring clean drinking water to people in need all over the world. Harrison says right now about 800 million people don't have clean water, and the water they do drink is making them sick.
Their ponds, their rivers, the stuff that you or I would never think of even letting our dog drink from, and it's the only sources in these poor rural communities. So we fund simple solutions, solutions like hand-dug wells, like drilling wells, spring protections, rainwater harvesting systems, biosand filters, taking surface water and cleaning it. And we've been able to fund about 6,600 projects in the last 6 years and raise over $70 million to help 2.5 million people.
Charity Water provides clean water to people in 20 countries. To avoid the pitfalls of charities who take profit or use money collected for administrative costs, they set up a system to ensure that each dollar donated goes directly into providing clean water to populations in need.
So after the work is completed, every single donor, you know, even if you only gave $7, says here's where your $7 went. 100% of the $7, because a small group of donors pays for the operating costs and the websites and even the credit card transaction fees.
Harrison says data has changed how his organization can deliver clean water to communities and also how it monitors clean drinking wells that it sets up.
Just the fact that, you know, a handheld GPS device costs $100 is pretty cool. So you can know where you are anywhere in the world, even if you're in a remote Ethiopian village for the cost of about $100. And, you know, Google Maps is free, so you can make all of this data that you're collecting public, make it transparent. We're really excited about a new project where we're going to be installing a bunch of sensors, thousands of sensors in these water projects to monitor their effectiveness, to make sure that they are continuing to serve people over time.
More information about the Clean Water Project is at charitywater.org. And for more on big data, visit humanfaceofbigdata.com and on Twitter at humanfaceofbigdata. Participants at the conference today emphasized that even though the impact of big data is all around us, what can be seen today is only a glimmer of what is possible. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.
And that's some of the news for Tuesday, October 2nd, 2012. The news was produced in New York with Jose Santiago, Linda Perry, and Phil Bader. I'm Andrea Sears in New York for the WBAI, listener-supported news.